KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Mary Wong, a senior policy director at the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, also known as ICANN. Mary is someone who I've known for several years. She was formerly a tenured professor at Franklin Pierce School of Law, which is now the University of New Hampshire. I got to know her through intellectual property professor circles over the last several years, and then last year she joined ICANN as a senior policy director. Now, when I say ICANN here, it's not an acronym that is associated with the Obama campaign. It's not I Hope. ICANN refers, as I mentioned, to the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which is the organization that has been designated and has been operating the basic administration of the Internet for the last several years. And Mary will talk more about that history. The ICANN has been known as the entity that makes sure that domain names are registered correctly, that makes sure that there is compliance with rules that involve how the Internet operates. It really runs that backbone. But as a result, and we'll talk about it, perhaps as a result of the revelations with regard to Edward Snowden and NSA spying, ICANN has now become much more prominent, at least in mainstream discussion, because ICANN is going to be slowly taking over the administrative responsibilities of operating the Internet that had previously been run by the U.S. National Telecommunications Information Administration, that has been working with ICANN for years to operate the Internet. And so the NTIA, as it's known, is going to be moving its administration responsibilities over to ICANN, which is an international organization. And that transition is one that's rife with controversy. Like any transition, there are benefits and drawbacks, but Mary's job puts her at the center of that issue. And so today we're going to have this procedural but very important discussion of how the Internet operates through ICANN and what ICANN is, and then we're going to spend really the second half of the show getting into the details of this transition and Mary's perspective on it. As you know, you think about these issues from an Internet perspective, we spend most of our time on Hearsay Culture discussing a lot of very substantive issues with regard to the Internet, the speech issues and issues involving privacy and how people communicate with each other and how intellectual property law operates there and so forth. What we don't spend as much time on the show are these very, other than our discussion of infrastructural issues with people like Brett Frischman, we haven't had a lot of discussion of the nuts and bolts administration of ICANN, I mean of the Internet through ICANN. In fact, as I was saying to Mary in our pre-discussion, the only time that ICANN's really come up on Hearsay Culture is when we've talked about domain name disputes, which is front and center with ICANN. In fact, ICANN has a whole procedure involving domain name disputes and disputes involving who owns names and so forth. But other than that, we haven't spent a lot of time with ICANN. But now that ICANN is taking on this even more prominent role, this is a perfect time to have Mary on. So as I mentioned, Mary joined ICANN as a senior policy director in 2013. She's part of the team that focuses on global policy development work. And she's also involved, and we'll talk about it a bit, the Generic Name Supporting Organization, which we'll talk about a bit on the show. As I mentioned, prior to joining ICANN, she was a tenured professor at Franklin Pierce, which is now the University of New Hampshire. She holds a bachelor's from the National University of Singapore, a master's from Cambridge University, United Kingdom. She is joining us via Skype from New Hampshire, and she is also recording, and I should point out we were recording the show on April 22nd, 2014. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much for having me on the show, Dave. I'm really excited to be here, to be working with you, and also to get the opportunity to explain to folks a bunch of different things, because since joining ICANN, and in fact, before that, when I was assisting with some of the policy development work as a community volunteer, like many of the folks I work with, I came to realize that there's quite a lot of misconceptions and myths about ICANN. What is it that we do, for example? And certainly now that there's this announcement from the U.S. government about his transition. I think it's very important to be able to set the record straight, but also to get people interested in what it is that we do, because literally anyone who uses the Internet, the domain name system to search for a web address or to go online shopping, for example, does deal with us at some level, whether they know it or not.
So yeah, Mary, let's start there and tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested in these issues.
Well, Dave, as you mentioned in the introduction, and that was very kind, thank you very much. I was a law professor teaching intellectual property, you know, copyrights, trademarks, and some internet law. And I got involved, if I can, through some nonprofit and basically some non-commercial advocates who were involved in internet governance issues. And because in ICANN, as we can explain slightly later on, it is composed of a community of people, groups, organizations, governments with different interests and with different constituencies, if you like, I was asked if I could participate given my academic expertise and my interest in internet-related matters concerning IP. So before I knew it, this was, I want to say June 2008, that was my first ICANN meeting. Before I knew it, shortly after that, some seats opened up on the council for the generic name supporting organization that you mentioned earlier. And essentially the GNSO deals with policy development work for all generic top-level domains like .com, .org, .info, .biz, etc., etc. And on the council, each constituency has a certain number of seats, and so I was persuaded to run for one, and I got it. And so for 4 years before I joined ICANN as a staff member, I was working as part of the bottom-up community-driven process that ICANN operates on. And so in some ways, I brought a first-hand experience from one side of the curtain, or one side of the stage, as you were, to my staffing role, which, as you mentioned, I've been there less than a year. So it's been an interesting journey for me. I've certainly learned a lot about not just the substantive issues, but the processes that policies get developed at ICANN. And it's a fairly unique organization, a fairly unique process that I'd be happy to speak more to.
Yeah, let's start here because, again, many listeners to Hearsay Culture will be familiar with ICANN, but I think an equal number won't be. So describe in more detail, you started talking about the role of ICANN in the operations of the Internet and where it's located.
Right. So forgive me to those listeners, as an apology, who know a lot more about this. It's not meant to oversimplify, but I do feel like I do need to start off by saying that, you know, ICANN deals with the domain name system, and while the domain name system is a very important part of the Internet, it is not the Internet, just as the World Wide Web is not the Internet. I think that's kind of an important starting point. Mm-hmm. And so when one talks about the role of ICANN, essentially, we deal with domain name system issues. So the actual domain names, the internet protocols that attach to those names, and the different internet protocol addresses that get distributed regionally around the world. So in some ways, ICANN can be seen as a very technical body because a lot of the work that we do is technical in nature. It does involve dealing with name servers, for example. But the policy work that comes into it deals with policies insofar as they affect the administration of all those technical functions. And as time has gone by, ICANN was set up in 1998, in October 1998. And in the 15 years that has elapsed, I think more and more people within ICANN and outside of ICANN who have come into the community have realized that a lot of the policy development work does have far-reaching implications beyond just the technical. And so this leads me to the point about involvement in ICANN, and you'd asked a question, Dave, about where we are. I assume that mm-hmm. we can start off with the geographical location.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, this gives me the chance to, if you like, debunk a couple of the myths.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
As we go on.
Yeah, please.
It is true that ICANN is essentially or was formed as a U.S. corporation. Specifically, it's a California not-for-profit corporation. And that really is a historic fact based on the fact that if we remember the mid to late 90s when the Internet and the web and e-commerce and all manner of uses, commercial and non-commercial uses of the internet really exploded. I want to say, well, it's probably a little before that, right? And the U.S. government, having been prime in the evolution of this network of networks, did what to me was a very visionary thing, which was to make the decision that neither it nor any other government or group of governments was going to control this thing, right, if I can use that technical term. And to cut a long story short, ICANN was set up to administer the domain name system and all the technical things that I mentioned earlier. So that's why and how it was set up. But like I said, as time has passed, more and more members of the community have realized that it is not necessarily just a place for technical geeks to come develop protocols and programs. That's a huge part of the sort of things that we do to keep the domain name system up running and to keep the internet safe and secure as a result of that. But there's a lot of different policy work that touch on, say, intellectual property interests or development of the domain name industry or other business interests, and certainly in terms of certain other concerns that are very fundamentally important, like freedom of speech and protection of privacy rights of different individuals. So this is really not a U.S. issue. It really has very little to do with ICANN being a U.S. corporation, because the internet and the domain name system is a global resource. It is something to be taken care of by the global community. So one thing I want to say is that the community at ICANN is not necessarily just comprised of Americans. If you come to an ICANN meeting or join one of our working groups, you will find that there are people from literally, you know, all the five regions that ICANN recognizes, you know, North America, Latin and South America, Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia and the Pacific. So then recently, our CEO, who's been CEO for only just a couple of years, and he has launched a number of projects since he's arrived, which has kept everybody running very, very quickly. And we can talk about this when we talk about the transition of the U.S. government stewardship. You know, really said to us, we need to formalize the internationalization of ICANN in the sense that we need to be truly representative of the community and we need to be responsive to the community. And, you know, just to give you a very simple example, if we have a registrar, for example, in Asia, or we have someone with an issue, you know, in Europe, it's not always that easy for them to wait till the LA office is up and running and doing business, even though those folks keep fairly long hours. Mm-hmm. So the decision was taken that we do need to be in the communities that are part of our community. And so we now have offices not just in the United States. In the United States, we have offices in LA and DC. We've long had an office in Brussels in Europe, and now we also have one in Geneva. And the two recent hub offices that opened are in Istanbul and in Singapore. So rather than see ICANN as a purely U.S.-based corporation, the moves that the corporation has taken recently are really to underscore the fact that it is a global community.
So we're chatting with Mary Wong of ICANN on KTSFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Mary, to set this framework, and you've done a lot of it here, but I want to just make sure it's clear. So when we're talking about domain names, we're talking about the .com, .edu, .org, .net, and so forth. And ICANN's role, for those, again, that don't focus, comes at that domain name level. So when I purchase a domain name, when I go to one of the registrars, one of the entities that are designated to handle registration of domain names, and I pick my name, so I have hearsayculture.com, how does ICANN get involved there? What happens behind the scenes that involves ICANN when one acquires a domain name?
That's a great question, Dave, and it's one of those basic things that folks generally don't think about because they don't have to think about it. And so someone like yourself, and if we take the example of hearsayculture.com, in sort of, you know, domain name industry parlance, you'd be the registrant, right? The person who registers and holds a domain name. or several domain names, as the case may be. And as you mentioned, you do that by purchasing it and entering into an agreement with a registrar, who is an entity, and GoDaddy is probably the best known because it is the largest registrar. There's a number, obviously, in different countries around the world. You're really, as a registrant, your dealings are almost exclusively, certainly primarily, just with your registrar. So the bit that sort of goes on behind the scenes, as it were, is that the registrar that you deal with would generally have a contract with ICANN. Mm-hmm. ICANN has a list of accredited registrars, and we have an accreditation agreement with each of them. But beyond that, there is also another type of organization called the registry, and that entity also has a contract with ICANN. So in essence, ICANN has contracts with two types of entities, the registrars with whom you register a domain name, and the registries. And the registry operators are really the entities that, well, I'm going to use the word operate again, the .com in your case, or .org in another case, or .net, .mobi, etc., etc. And as a registrant, you would almost certainly, almost never go or deal directly with the registry. But the way that the domain name system of registration operates is that we have the registry, the registrar, and the registrant, and ICANN has contracts with the first two. And those contracts, you know, are like any other contract. They're between two parties, they're negotiated, and of course they're enforceable. So if there are complaints or compliance issues, we would have to deal with them if they get reported to us.
So when we're thinking about ICANN, and we're thinking about domain names, let me ask you again, these are kind of framework questions. The domain name operates as basically an easy way to type in an IP address, an internet protocol address, which is a series of digits. And those series of digits, of course, are assigned through this system. There has been, as you know, but I want to emphasize this, there's been a change in IP protocol over the last several years because we were running out of digits and running out of numbers. And a few years ago, I had Laura Denardis on, who's now an American, who talked about these issues. What is the role of ICANN beyond registering domain names? What else does ICANN do? And I think this is what you were alluding to earlier as well, to help support this functionality of the internet.
Right, and again, that's a great question. Thank you for asking all these framework questions, Dave, because I very rarely get a chance to speak to them, and I do think they're important. I agree with you on that aspect of it.
Well, again, I don't think, quite frankly, Mary, I just don't think most people, even those that focus on these issues, are fully aware of what ICANN exactly does, and more importantly, as we're going to get to, what it doesn't do. So go ahead and add and answer this question. That'd be great.
Right. And you had spoken to Internet Protocol addresses, or the IP addresses, mm-hmm. and you had alluded to essentially what those people who are working on these things would know as the migration from IPv4 to IPv6.
Yes.
And a lot of those technical standards development, if I can use the word very generically, so any really technically minded people who are listening, please forgive me on this score, but it's a lot easier to explain if I use fairly generic terms. So the development of a lot of those protocols isn't done by ICANN, because mm-hmm. if we take a step back and we look at the internet, right, like I said earlier, the domain name system is a big part, but it's not the internet. If we look at another piece of this, domain names, in contrast to IP addresses, as you said, Dave, is a series of digits. Domain names literally are recognizable words, right? And the examples that we often use, but we can touch on how it's changing, is domain names in a Latin-based script, or, you know, the English language, for example, or French or anything else like that. Mm-hmm. And as I think many of us know, in order for things to function on the internet, the sort of word-based domain name has to match the digit-based IP address. And that's really where ICANN comes in the sense of the coordination of the allocation of domain names as well as the IP addresses, and also coordinating the different parameters and the protocols that go into that coordination function. So one of the little known facts about ICANN, you know, digging a little deeper, Dave, is that I can really coordinate, like I said, allocation and assignment of three different types of identifiers. And there are three unique types of identifiers that comprise this part of the Internet. The domain names, which is part of a system that we call the domain name system, the words-based names that we type into our address bars, the IP addresses, and the related ports and parameter numbers and protocols. That may be getting a little bit too much for folks who don't really need to know these things, but essentially you had asked what it is that we do, and that's really what we do. And that's why I said earlier that some folks may, you know, simply say that it's a purely technical function. And of course, the other piece of this is that in coordinating this technical function, there is a policy development function that's fairly significant, and in fact is in our bylaws. The ICANN bylaw sets out what I've just described, and it also expressly states that ICANN coordinates policy development that's reasonably and appropriately related to these technical functions. Mm-hmm. And that's really how I got involved, to get back to an earlier question that you asked. And if I may add something here, one of the very important core values that guides what ICANN does and has from the beginning, and this will come into play when we talk about what's happening recently, is that in doing the technical work and in performing the policy development work that goes along with it, one primary concern, in fact, the primary concern, is supposed to be the operational stability, the reliability, and the security of the Internet. And that really has to frame everything that we do, either on the technical side or the policy side.
We're chatting with Mary Wrong of ICANN on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. No, Mary, you know, the of course, on probably virtually every other show you might be on, the answer you just gave would be too technical, but this is Hearsay Culture, and so you've got a good run of geeks and wannabe geeks that listen to the show for whom this is hopefully why they tune in. And for those that aren't geeks, the framing of the issue is important. So the reason why I ask those questions, and it ties to what we're going to talk about after the break, is that there's a lot of, I think, misunderstanding as to exactly how it is that one, when one logs on to the Internet through their Internet access provider, that they're able to be directed to a web page. And so when we're talking about, and you alluded to it, I want to ask you, when you're talking to people about ICANN, what is your perception of the public's understanding of it, to the extent that they have it at all? In other words, what is the predominant, you mentioned misconceptions, but I'll ask you more specifically, what is the prominent conception of ICANN, correct or not, that you run into talking to people about the institution?
Well, I think there's, at the very high level, there's probably a couple of, well, let's say two things, right? One is that we control, that we regulate the Internet. And the partial answer to that, as I think I've stated a couple of times, is that what we do is not the Internet, right? The other piece of the answer is that we don't actually deal with, much less control or regulate or touch the content of websites that may have, in fact, of course, they will have domain names that people use. So, for example, let's go back to hearsayculture.com. We may think we know what hearsay culture is by looking at the domain name, and of course, having got that domain name, we put it in, you know, the domain name system. But at ICANN, we don't know, and we don't deal with anything that, Dave, you put on hearsayculture.com as content. And I would say that is probably the biggest misconception that people have when speaking to me about ICANN and what we do. So I guess the other piece that I would say, the second thing, is it's usually easier for me to tell people what we don't do, at least non-technical people, than to tell them what we do, which is what I tried to do a few minutes ago. So I generally say, you know, we don't do content, we don't do spam, for example, and we don't just do technical development work. And in fact, if I may at this point add that ICANN doesn't act alone in all of this. We had spoken briefly about IP addresses, and I talked a little bit about development of technical standards. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other bodies, if you like, that are involved in this space, and while each may perform somewhat different functions, there is a coordinating role that I can play to some extent, but they are part of what we can call the Internet ecosystem. And these bodies include the Internet Engineering Task Force, or the IETF, the Internet Architecture Board, or the IAB, and certainly when we come back to the allocation of IP addresses, whether it's IPv4, IPv6, we have some very important entities called the Regional Internet Registries. And ICANN works very closely with all of these different entities and bodies, again, to ensure that, you know, the Internet is not just operational, but it's safely and securely so that it's reliable and it's globally accessible, just so that the individual registrant, and not even a registrant, it could be someone who's coming to hearsayculture.com and trying to figure out what this show is about, has never registered a domain name in his or her life, that individual Internet user doesn't have to worry about who's a registrar and who's a registry and what's an IP address. They just need to know that it works.
We're chatting with Mary Wong of ICANN on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU-FM, which is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu, speaking of domain names, and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue listening to the show. So Mary, let's start, talking about what's happening now with that framework. I mentioned in the introduction that the U.S. National Telecommunications and Information Administration is going to be ending its relationship, at least a formal relationship, with ICANN in 2015. So talk about the NTIA and its role in ICANN up to now.
Okay. And, this is really, to go back to your introduction, Dave, what thrust ICANN in the news to an extent probably greater than before, in the sense that even domain name registrants, much less users of websites, probably didn't know, and some of them didn't actually care who or what ICANN was. So suddenly now, everyone's sort of abuzz with what's going on. In order to really fully address your question, Dave, I think I need to sort of step back a little bit in time. And
sure.
I talked earlier about ICANN being set up in October 1998, which is when I said 15 years ago. So it's going to be 16 by the time we get to later this year. And one of the things that, unless you are someone who tracks, the history and the development of ICANN and of related issues, very few people are aware that this was what's recently been announced is sort of the next step in a process that began back there. Because listeners will recall that I spoke about the U.S. government basically saying that there should not be, control of the DNS, the domain name system, by any one government, even if it is the U.S. government or any sets of governments. And so this is sort of the latest step in the process. If I can then look at the relationship between ICANN and the U.S. government, the form of that relationship, there was something called a joint project agreement, which was a contract, essentially, between the U.S. government and ICANN. But again, few people know that several years ago, this was replaced by something called the Affirmation of Commitments, which is a fairly short document, if one is used to long contracts and so forth, that sets out certain responsibilities and obligations, particularly on ICANN's part. And one of those responsibilities and obligations, amongst many important ones, is that it keeps this framework of being accountable and transparent in its development and policymaking processes. And I'd like to speak a little to that in a little while.
Sure.
This is important because I think it shows sort of the transition of the relationship. It's not like things started in 98 and then suddenly, come September 2015, there's going to be the sea change. A lot of things have been happening in terms of the format of the relationship between ICANN and the U.S. government changing in the last 15 years. So basically where we were as of, March 13th this year, because the announcement that we're speaking of was made on March 14th, and that will be a very memorable Friday for many of us, is that there is no contract as such. governing the big relationship between ICANN and U.S. government, the contract that one hears spoken of is actually a much narrower, slightly different contract for ICANN to perform what is known as the IANA function. Mm-hmm. Right, or the Internet Assigned Names Authority. And again, many folks listening to this program will not need me to explain the IANA function, and it might take a little bit too much time to do that. But essentially, when there are new domain names or top-level domain names, they have to go into the DNS root zone, and the IANA functions does take care of that, as well as a number of other related tasks. And again, it's a fairly technical function, but if we look back at what I said about ICANN's core values and mission, it really is pretty critical that these things are done smoothly, that they're done to ensure security, stability, and so forth. And so that's really what the U.S. government's role has been. It has been overseeing the IANA functions through a contract with ICANN that expires in September 2015, and it's been renewed before. So I think most folks would then expect that this contract will come up for renewal, and it, you know, there may be some discussions as to how that's being performed, and it may be renewed next year. So the announcement on March 14th may have taken people who are not closely watching the process a little bit by surprise. But the point that I want to make here, in addition to what I've said before, is that insofar as the U.S. government is concerned, and they say this in their public announcement, and you can see find that on the NTIA website, is that the relationship and ICANN specifically in its performance of the IANA function has reached a point where it makes sense for the transition to happen. And here's the last thing I want to say on this point before handing it back to you, because I'm sure you have other questions, Dave.
Yeah, sure.
Is that what I've seen people talk about, whether on blogs or even in media coverage, is that they're talking about transition of the IANA function. And that's really not what's happening. The IANA function is what it's always been, if I can risk sounding a little flip here. Mm-hmm. And ICANN has performed the technical task related to that, like I said, under a contract for many, many years. That function doesn't change. What's changing is the U.S. government's role in being the steward, if you like, of that function. And at this point, I'd like to go back to something you said in the introduction. What it's transitioning to, I think, is just as important as the fact as to what is being transitioned. So like I said, what's being transitioned is the U.S. government's role as a steward, as an overseer of the function. What is transitioning to is really, to me, what is more interesting and exciting about what's going on right now, because folks assume that they're handing it over to ICANN. So I've heard people say, well, then that's kind of interesting. You're performing the function and then you're watching over yourself. I mean, that's not technically accurate. If one looks back at the NTIA announcement and in all the discussions that have gone on in which the U.S. government has participated, including in a couple of recent hearings before Congress, the transition is going to happen by going to what I think has been identified as the global internet community. And it is ICANN that's going to oversee that process of transition. So in other words, ICANN is going to be the facilitator rather than the recipient of that process. And I lied when I said this, the last thing I wanted to say before handing it back.
I'm giving you free rein. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you. Because I realized that something that I think I've assumed, but maybe I haven't said expressly, and I probably should, is that the global internet community, I've said before, it's represented at ICANN through a number of constituencies, groups, and so forth. But what's important to remember about how that representation occurs is that ICANN doesn't do, you know, policy development work just in a vacuum and present it to the global community. Many of the policies, including the dispute resolution policy that you mentioned earlier, Dave, is done through working groups and other groups that are formed by the community, that are comprised of community volunteers, as I myself once was, and those policies only become adopted by ICANN if they go through this process, reach a level of consensus, and the ICANN board is satisfied that it's done so. And so when one speaks of the transition to the global internet community, what the U.S. government said was this is the global multi-stakeholder community. And I would imagine that, you know, one reason why ICANN was asked to facilitate this transition is not just because we've been performing the INF functions for such a long time, but because ICANN is probably the best known place, and I use that word sort of virtually, where there is a very strong multi-stakeholder community that has significant experience in, you know, governance and in developing policies and working through a consensus-based model. And I really think that's something that's critical for listeners to bear in mind.
How much of the transition from the NTIA's oversight, if you will, to ICANN is subject to NTIA requirements? I mean, the NTIA is not handing over these responsibilities, and by, and I'm using it euphemistically, is not moving away from its role and saying that ICANN do whatever you want. What conditions, if any, has NTIA put on this transition?
So, again, you know, you're asking great questions. Let me first restate, but sort of, you know, talk a little bit more about something that you said, that the U.S. government is not going away, and it's said very clearly it's not going away.
Mm-hmm.
And in a number of ways that, again, may not be apparent to folks not too familiar with the ICANN multi-stakeholder community. The first thing is that governments are a stakeholder group, and governments are part of the ICANN community through an organization called the Government Advisory Committee, or the GAC, that provides advice to the ICANN board on, you know, pretty much any issue that the GAC believes has public policy implications or that impacts the interests of governments. The U.S. government is a very active participant on the GAC. So that's one way it's been participating or continue to participate. The second thing, or the second way, is the affirmation of commitments that I spoke of a while ago. And like I said, that's an understanding between the U.S. government and ICANN. And as part of the affirmation of commitments, ICANN has to undergo a process of reviews of different aspects of its organization on a regular basis. And one of these reviews is, as I mentioned, accountability and transparency, basically how well we're doing. And the U.S. government representative, Lauren Strickling, right, from the NTIA, is ex officio to those reviews. So you're right, the U.S. government's not going anywhere. And to answer your question more specifically, the U.S. government was very, very clear in its March 14th announcement, and in every subsequent discussion that it's had, whether informally at an ICANN meeting with stakeholders or more formally when testifying before Congress, it's laid out certain principles for that transition. And one of these principles is that whatever it is that we're transitioning to, the proposal that ICANN is going to facilitate for it to come back to the U.S. government for its consideration has to support and enhance the multi-stakeholder model. That was like principle number one. And there's a few other principles having to do with, again, you know, the resiliency and the security of the Internet. One thing it also emphasized is that, and I was there when Larry Strickling said this, and he said it several times, and I was there a few times, he says very clearly that the U.S. government will not accept a proposal that replaces the NTIA role with a government, right, or a government-led solution, or even an intergovernmental organization solution.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably in response to some concerns that were, you know, bubbling up here and there, that the transition may be to the United Nations or an agency like the International Telecoms Union or to a different government. And I feel very comfortable saying that this won't be the case because Secretary Strickling has said so on very many occasions, very clearly and very, very firmly. So, like I said, this is kind of an exciting period because we're only at the start of the transition process. And like I said, ICANN is facilitating that process. And that process, according to the NTIA, has to end up enhancing the multi-stakeholder model. So we don't actually know the specific form of that model yet, but what we're working on now is trying to craft a proposal that will follow the principles the NTIA has laid out. And of course, that proposal has to go back to the NTIA for its consideration. And one of the things that's happening here is that as part of the facilitative role, ICANN is forming a steering group that will consist of representatives from all the different stakeholder groups that participate at ICANN, and that will also have representatives from the technical community. So that's kind of going to be a fairly elaborate process that we're only just starting now.
And I want to ask you about that in a moment, Mary. And we're chatting with Mary Wong of ICANN on KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. Mary, we're at the point of the show where I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking you questions that you don't have time to answer fully. And you have been you've taken full advantage of the time I've given you, and now I'm warning you that you'll have less time to get into the weeds. And I give that warning because I want to ask this, you know, the pressing question, which I know, ICANN has received, and the criticism. I'll read you a quote from, this is a quote from a representative of NetChoice, you know, the industry lobbying organization that represents a number of trade interests on technology in the U.S. And when this was announced, as you mentioned last month, again in mid-March 2014, this representative, Steve Del Bianco, was quoted in an article that PC World ran, saying, and this is what he said. He said, "I hope it's," and the "it's" being, of course, this move towards ICANN, "I hope it's not just a frightened reaction to the Snowden revelations, which have nothing to do with the Internet domain name system. Maybe the administration wants to rack up political points for upcoming Internet governance meetings, but I'm afraid those points won't be worth what this move may cost," unquote. You know, and so the concern that has been raised is that the U.S. even stewardship of the Internet that's allowed for it to grow is now going to be undermined by the international community and by players who do not have the interest of an open Internet in mind, and that the move towards ICANN is a way for the administration to, you know, throw the proverbial political bone to its allies who are criticizing it for the behavior of the NSA vis-a-vis the Internet. So how do you respond to this statement by the executive director of NetChoice, and more broadly to this concern that the Internet and the domain name system will now be subject to the whims of countries that don't value or want an open Internet and so forth?
Well, Dave, first of all, I should say that I actually know Steve quite well.
I imagine you did, and I didn't want to make this a personal thing, so I'm not, you know.
No, not at all. And Steve is actually one of the veteran participants in the ICANN community and extremely well-respected. And I think what he was saying there, I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, was really expressing a concern at a fairly general level that a lot of users might legitimately feel, particularly as they may not know many details about ICANN, number one, and number two, what this whole transition means. And like I said, that may be because of lack of awareness of all the sort of intricate things that are going on. So I guess as a first response, I would refer back to what I said earlier, that this was not something that happened all of a sudden, that, oh my gosh, now we have to do something. Like I said, if you look at the relationship between the U.S. government and ICANN and how that's changed over time, you know, from the JPA to the affirmation of commitments, and look at what the NTIA itself, through Secretary Strickling, has been saying publicly, I would say that clearly puts that concern to rest quite firmly and quite clearly. I think the other thing I would say, or one of the other things I would say, is if we look at the emphasis on the multi-stakeholder process and the fact that that's one of the first principles that the NTIA pointed to, that's something that is alive and well in ICANN. Like I said, everything in terms of important policy decisions that are taken, that doesn't happen without multi-stakeholder community consultation, dialogue, public comments, and so forth. And everything that happens, every single working group call, and there are dozens of working groups ongoing at the moment, is recorded, is transcribed, and it's published. And that to me is the strength of a multi-stakeholder model. And I want to say this too, not because I'm a staff member of ICANN, and I've only been a staff member less than a year, but I've been a community participant like Steve and many others for over 4 years before that. And I think many people continue to participate at ICANN. We don't get paid as volunteers for this because of the strength of the belief in the multi-stakeholder model. And, you know, if we take a step back from that and ask why, there's a lot of people who are technical. There's a lot of people who are not, myself included. But if we look at the development of the Internet itself, that has always been fueled by the desire for innovation, right? And that has always been concerned with preservation of openness. That's why we have this network of networks that's open and end-to-end. And many of the people, and this is one of the things I find very amazing, not just about ICANN, but the IETF and a number of these other related organizations, they were there at the beginning of ICANN. The chair of the ICANN board, Dr. Steve Crocker, he's a very, very well-known figure and one of the founders of many of the things that we use today on the Internet. Vint Cerf is another famous name that folks know, who was a member of the ICANN board and who recently chaired a high-level panel at ICANN dealing with innovation. So there's a lot of trusty stewards, stalwarts, and veterans who believe in the model. There's a lot of newer people like myself that believe in it. And I think that coupled with the assurances that we've gotten from the U.S. government, I'm not sure what else anyone can say that, to my mind, would really lay to rest that concern. And like I said, it's not just statements, that you read about in the press, but just looking at how the multi-stakeholder model has developed, evolved, matured, and works, I think that's probably the best testimony of all.
So, Mary, we have about 6 minutes left, and I want to ask you, I mean, there's more we could talk about on this, too, but I think you've addressed it pretty well. Let's talk about this new process that you're putting together. Again, this is not happening tomorrow. This is happening over the period, really, of the next year plus. So give us a sense of where we are now. I know that there was a meeting a few weeks ago in Singapore where ICANN started talking about these things. Give us a report, if you would, as to where things are in these early stages and what you anticipate happening as far as this process and putting together this new governance model in the coming months.
Right. So a lot has happened, Dave, and I think a number of our community participants are just saying that there's so much that's happening. But before I answer the question, I would just say that I think Secretary Strickling also mentioned that even though we're looking at September 2015 as when the contract with ICANN expires, I mean, that's obviously driving a lot of these things, but we want to get it right rather than meet some sort of artificial date. So where we are now is that after the meeting in Singapore that you mentioned, and that's actually a regular ICANN meeting. ICANN has 3 regular public meetings a year, one in each of the 5 geographic global regions. And so the last one's in Singapore in the Asia Pacific. The next one will be in June in London in Europe. There was a lot of community discussion, and the community discussions happened live, and they also happened online and through a bunch of mailing lists. And as a result, I mentioned the steering group, that was the proposal that was put forward. So where we are now is that comments are being received by ICANN on some of the structural proposals. The steering group is going to be formed, I believe, by the time of the London meeting. And a process has been laid out for not just who's going to be on the steering group, because we know that there's going to be representatives from each of the technical communities and the constituencies, but now there has to be a selection process. But there's also a process laid out for how that group's going to do its work And embedded in that process is some of the things that I mentioned, a public comment period, draft to be reviewed by the community, suggestions to be made by consensus and so forth. So that's really where we are, just really setting the framework and the timeline. There's going to be ongoing discussions in between, not just the meeting from last month in Singapore to London, but beyond London as well. And there is a timeline that is on the ICANN website that listeners can find with some diagrams that try to describe where things look like they're going at this point.
So Mary, let me ask you along with that process, right? This is kind of the pushback concern question, because many commentators have taken a position that this transition is really it's important, but it's not big news in the sense that there has to be any concern about the structural integrity of the internet. Certainly, the domain name system. Is one, and I'm speaking personally here, that was under much, there is no threat to the domain name system per se. The bigger threat to the domain name system existed, for example, a couple of years ago if SOPA and PIPA had passed the Stop Online Piracy Act, which talked about removing websites from the internet and so forth. But let me ask you the horror scenario version and get your reaction to it. So ICANN begins a process that's multi-stakeholder and transparent, and as a result, Egypt, under its current leadership, decides, or Syria, becomes involved in domain name governance issues at ICANN. Take it from there. What's your reaction to that kind of concern that you're going to have countries that have shown a preponderance to, while being connected to the global internet, have shown a preponderance to cutting off the internet? And of course, that's a content-based restriction, but it is a very physical infrastructural move along the lines of something that ICANN could at some level be involved in. At least that would be the concern. So what's your response? And again, unfair question, because I'm asking you to respond to that concern or debunk that concern in the next 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, I'll try.
Yep.
I guess it is a concern that a lot of people have expressed. And again, I think that's also a lot of people who, for very valid reasons, don't track a lot of the things that's going on very closely. So the first thing I'll say, Dave, is I mentioned the GAC, or the Government Advisory Committee, before, and there's, no sort of limitation on governments. There, any government that wishes to participate can send representatives to the GAC. And again, on the ICANN website, you can see a list of the governments. And there are governments on there that listeners may be a little surprised to find that they participate as part of the ICANN multi-stakeholder community. So that's not new in the sense that it's not one of these members-only clubs, only certain governments allowed into. I think the second thing I would say is that you're right. There's a lot of core functions that we do, going back to what I said earlier, where a lot of this stuff that we've just talked about isn't key. And there's a lot of issues that we're working on concerning privacy, concerning trademark protections, and certainly concerning the launch of over 1,000 new generic top-level domains, not to mention the country code ones that are going to go in along with the dot-coms that we all know. That work continues. And that actually, if you only read the media buzz, you don't realize that that actually is a bulk of a lot of things that I spend my day on working on with the many stakeholders. So I would like to think that a lot of these conversations, they have to be had because there are a lot of concerns from regular citizens, internet users, that should be aired and discussed. But that this is also part of a broader conversation, Dave, that is more than just about ICANN. It's part of a broader conversation about internet governance, and I've mentioned some of the other organizations, the so-called I-STAR organizations, along with ICANN, governments, civil society, and those conversations are also happening. So what we're talking about with respect to the U.S. government's announcement, with respect to the role of ICANN, that's part of that bigger conversation. So it's not a pure ICANN problem. It's something that ICANN is involved with as a participant and now as a facilitator of the transition process, but it's not unique.
Mary Wong, Senior Policy Director at ICANN. Thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. This is a topic which, of course, is again, you know, it's gotten that media hit. I suspect that what's going to happen is ICANN will fade back, at least from front page news, and you will be doing the diligent work of making sure that we continue to have the internet functioning the way it does. I am, as I mentioned in the introduction, I'm a fan of you and your work. I look forward to following in and staying in touch, but for now, I will simply thank you for being on Hearsay Culture and educating my listeners on this very critically important and, as you indicated, not well understood role. Thank you much.
Thank you, Dave. And if I may, like I said, everyone is a participant at
ICANN. Yeah.
And even if you can't go to an ICANN meeting, you can join in many of the working groups and follow all the discussions that are happening online and recorded. Thanks very much.
And that's at ICANN.org.
Yes.
Great. I'm happy to mention a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture. I posted the schedule for this spring quarter yesterday. Again, I'm recording this show on April 22nd, 2014. So Mary Wong is going to be on tomorrow, so you'll hear it April 23rd. And then upcoming guests include Professor Albert Meyer of the Utrecht School of Governance on Open Data and Governance, my colleague Professor Laura Rozelle at Elon, co-author of the book Strategic Narratives, Communication Power in the New World Order. Larry Downs, author of Big Bang Disruption, a repeat guest on Hearsay Culture. Following that, Professor Evan Selinger of the Rochester Institute of Technology on Technology and the Human Experience. Looking forward towards the end of May to chat with Professors Ryan Kalo of the University of Washington and Woody Hartzog of Cumberland School of Law and Robotics Law. And rounding out this quarter, Nabiha Syed of Levine Sullivan Koch and Schultz in New York on drone technology and freedom of information. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can first listen to the show at 2 p.m. this quarter Pacific time on KZSU on Wednesdays by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 200-plus shows as well as the upcoming schedule. You can go to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes page for CIS. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KCSU for more diverse programming, and have a terrific day.